I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a swift collection of arts and culture from Birmingham and beyond. Defining the corners of the box this time around, we hear creative stories and challenges at first hand as I catch up with speakers at the recent Small Talk 2017 event. We illuminate our musical knowledge with the wonderful sound of klezmer from Sklamberg and the Shepherds, and there's also a slice of space country folk. Now, hiding out in back rooms can often be a rewarding experience. I joined a creative crowd and a choice selection of speakers at Bodego's recent Small Talk 2017 event at 1000 Trades in the city's Jewellery Quarter. I started with the opening speaker, glitch artist and self-proclaimed nerd, Antonio Roberts.
I'm with Antonio, who I think you describe yourself as a glitch artist. Is that right?
I'm a glitch artist, but more so I use glitch art as a method, as a process. So glitch art is basically kind of anything that involves brokenness or malfunctioning. So think about it, like if you ever watch TV in bad weather, or where you dropped your phone and it looks all weird afterwards, well, that's what I do. I can make that happen on purpose, and I do that sort of for a living in my artwork. But I'm also a curator as well, so it means like I organize exhibitions for galleries, and I work at one locally called Vivid Projects, and also independently.
Excellent. So how do you get into something like that? But secondly, what inspires that sort of approach to art? How did you arrive at it?
I'm a nerd. that's the best way to put it. Well, more so like I like detail, so I always liked to learn how things work. And so learning how something doesn't work, like when something breaks, you naturally have to figure out how it does work. And so when you do that, you get a fuller understanding of how a system might work. And discovering what glitch art was just Googling internet. I just tweeted someone saying, like, I want to do artwork like this. And he says, oh, this is glitch art. And then before I knew it, I was part of, like, this global community of other artists. And, yeah, it requires sometimes the naivety about how technology doesn't work or does work is good, like not knowing how a system works. You just kind of press buttons and then it might make something happen, it might not. It's the fun is in the experimentation of just trying it out and seeing what happens.
So I guess traditional art folks might say what you're trying to get to is something about perhaps decomposition and disruption, or is it?
Yes, disruption. Lots of the D words. So destruction, decomposition, just breaking things down through various means. So, like, yes, I'm talking about technology, but there's any sort of processes whereby you do something repeatedly and it gets worse. So, for example, photocopying. You make a photocopy of a photocopy. In the old VHS days, if you would make a recording from another VHS, it just keeps degrading. So that sort of way of thinking of things decomposing, but then that aesthetic, that how it looks, is quite interesting in itself to me, and hopefully to others.
So obviously, hopefully to others, tonight you're sharing some of those tips of the trade, if you like. You're talking about your art and your approach.
Well, I'm more talking about the curatorial aspects of my practice, because I still do glitch art, but for me, the thing that I'm focusing more on is the tools and the process, and more like how people are using that in their practice to express. So if you're talking about sort of breaking things down, like when people take popular imagery and sort of morph it in some way to make maybe a political point. So culture jacking, taking popular imagery and changing it in some way, which again, people do use glitch art to do that, but it's not exclusively to do with glitch art. But yeah, so tonight I'm more talking about that than the straight up glitch art.
And did you, through your investigation, if you like, of this type of art, did you, like in the X-Files, if you remember the X-Files in the good old days,
yes,
they discovered the Lone Gunman. Do you remember the Lone Gunman?
No,
they were
I don't.
A group of hackers who the FBI didn't know really existed.
Yeah.
And they found them and they were doing all these things about, you know, UFOs and all that kind of stuff. So did you find when you were investigating the art, did you find another ready group of artists who were sharing the same sort of principles?
Yeah, like the internet is an incredibly huge place. So what's great about it is that you could have an interest in anything, any very niche topic, and all you have to do is like type it into a search engine and you'll suddenly find another group of people who does it. So it's not quite like, you know, they are in the dark corners of the web, hiding from everyone else. They're just occupying a space which, at one time, there weren't that many people also doing it. Like, you'd have to be very specific about your interests. So, yeah, again, like, as soon as I kind of got involved in it, there was a festival of glitch art that took place in Chicago where everyone came together. The following year, in 2011, I brought it to Birmingham. And, yeah, there are many musicians and advertising agencies that are using this way of working in their films, in their music, in their advertising. So, yeah, it's but like it did definitely start like, oh, where's others? Wow, I thought it was just me. And luckily the internet allows you to find others.
Well, I'm massively intrigued now by what you've said, and I'm going to look forward to your talk.
Okay.
And for folks that want to explore a little bit more of who you are and what you do, where should they go?
Okay, well, my name is Antonio Roberts, so there aren't many of us in the world, so if you look on the internet, you'll find me. But also, my website is hellocatfood.com. I like cats, that's the reason it's called that. And then also, I work at a gallery called Vivid Projects, and currently, I put on exhibitions every so often on my own work. There's one coming from Copenhagen on the 5th of May, so if you happen to be there, but otherwise, yeah.
They're just passing.
Yeah, if you're just passing through Copenhagen, you know, go through there. But yeah, just generally speaking, though, on the internet, everywhere, I'm on social media, everything as Hello Cat Food, so...
Excellent. We will look that up very quickly
okay.
in case it changes. But Antonio, thanks very much.
No, you're welcome. Thank
Cheers,
you very
thanks.
Much.
Bye.
I wanted to explore how people are challenging copyright and talking about these issues of appropriation and things, but using digital tools. Because, yes, people have been copying since there have been things to copy. But with the internet, it means that we can do it at a much faster rate, i.e. means we can share an image and it goes around the world quickly. So this, you might have picked up one of these. It's just a program from the exhibition, which is on currently. And it's called No Copyright Infringement Intended. Because every time, like a lot of times when I see videos on YouTube that have been uploaded by someone that's not their material, they just put up this phrase to say, oh no, I'm not gonna get in trouble now. I've put up that phrase and I'm okay. Which to me just shows a disconnect between what people understand about it and how it's actually implemented. And it features the work of 10 artists. Again, some of them are quite serious, some of them are not. I'll talk about each of these individually. First, just a couple of shots of the exhibition itself. It's on in Leicester, so I forgot to mention that. It's at Phoenix in Leicester. This is the most highly academic one of these. So, you know, these images are from like 1700s, 1800s, and it's basically, you can get sued even if you were just using an image which is in the public domain, because the person who took the photograph owns the photograph. Don't worry if you don't understand that much currently about it, but yeah, so this artwork is reprinting them, and what you can see is people have put like watermarks all over them, and this one's heavily pixelated because the institution that owns the painting has said you can only use this version of it. But then you get into more lighthearted artworks. Who knows of Left Shark? Left Shark is a meme that was created in 2015 off the back of Katy Perry. She did a performance at the Super Bowl, which involved her performing and people were dressed up in animal costumes. And one of them on the left, or sorry, on stage left, was terrible at dancing. He was out of time. And so the whole internet dubbed him Left Shark. It just was kind of funny. There was no reason for it other than it's someone in a shark costume that looks a bit ridiculous on stage in front of millions of people. And one person, Fernando Souza, got inspired by this and decided to make a 3D model of it and just put it online for usage, for printing, whatever you want to do with it. And what happened is he got sued, or he tried to get sued, because suddenly the lawyers of Katy Perry were like, they kind of probably realized, there's a way to capitalize on this. The internet's sharing this meme. Let's try and say we own it. So the model was removed from the internet. They said that they then tried to own it, and they even tried to put in a trademark bid, despite the fact that they didn't create Left Shark. They just hired someone to dance in a shark costume, right? Which is not a sentence I say very often. They didn't create it, so this kind of appropriation is something that can happen with corporations doing it. And so, yeah, in the exhibition I have six 3D printed sharks. I can see that sometimes copyright can and is, quite frankly, a very boring topic. But as artists,
it's something that we will all encounter because we're all creating things that are inspired by other works, and we just have to be kind of be aware that we are inspired by others, and so to acknowledge others that we are inspired by, and also try and fight against these sorts of corporate appropriation, especially when it's one way.
Okay, so I'm with Chloe at Small Talk 2017, somewhere
Hello.
In the jewellery quarter, that
yes.
we've all managed to find.
Yes, just about.
And Chloe, you're one of the turns tonight, as it were.
Yep, I so am.
Just tell us a little bit about yourself, and not all of your talk, but what you're going to outline in your...
Okay, so I'm a composer and singer-songwriter, and I'm here today to talk about a piece I wrote that was performed about a month ago called The Girl Behind the Glass, which was a music theatre piece. Exploring sexual assault recovery and looking at that from a kind of symbolic point of view.
Okay, so that's quite a harrowing topic,
yes,
in some ways.
It is, yeah.
But how easy was that to explore as a topic?
It was quite difficult because I wanted to make sure the audience weren't going to switch off.
Yeah.
Because often when we come across harrowing things, our brains try and protect ourselves and we switch off. So it was about finding symbols that meant people could stay with the themes for longer, and just kind of have a lightness to it.
So at an event like this, you're talking about a creative process. Does that make perhaps the product a bit deeper for you? Do you understand it more when you kind of talk it through? Or
yeah, I think it's nice to be given the opportunity to reflect on it, and after you've had some space and once a performance has been done and you can reevaluate how well it went, how it feels for you and where you want to go next.
Now, in your description of what you did, you said you're a composer.
Yes.
Okay, so how does that differ from a songwriter?
It's interesting. I think composer, I suppose I write quite like contemporary classical music, and this had contemporary classical elements, but this piece also had songwriter elements. So I kind of combined my two things because I write and I perform my songs. So yeah, it's one of those labelling things that probably doesn't matter too much.
And are you always exploring kind of social issues?
I tend to do a range of things, but I like stories. So any stories, and then obviously social issues are stories in their own right. And I like to give voice to stories that don't always get as much attention as they should, and I think art is a really useful way of doing that. I had some feedback from the performance, and it seemed like it had been really effective for people to explore those stories through art as opposed to through day-to-day interactions.
So I'm with Dan Olker, who's the organiser.
Director is my official title.
That's a little bit more official, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of Bad Ego, is that how we're pronouncing
That's
it?
That's how you pronounce it, yeah. I'm not the original organiser of Bad Ego. There were a few guys who started it before me who decided upon the name, and they always hated the name, and now I see why, because no one knows how to pronounce it.
So let's talk about Small Talk and Small Talk 2017, where we are now. We're hiding on the landing, just behind it, if you like. Here at 1000 Trades, and there's a real mix of people, isn't there, on the agenda or the programme tonight?
Yeah, and that's what we try and promote. We are all about the arts in Birmingham. We want people who work in the creative community to come together of all different professions and learn from each other. There's a great thing with collaboration where you never know what's going to come from it. Even if just a conversation can spark new ideas, it can inspire you with people who don't necessarily do the same thing as you but do something very similar. And there's loads of potential for crossover, and it doesn't happen enough. And what we really try and promote is people learning about other people's industries, and in doing so you kind of, it opens new doors for you.
Now, in some ways, at the moment, the kind of the spoken word event is very much en vogue, isn't it? It's very popular. It's a very old idea.
We toyed with the idea for ages of having talks, because, like you said, it's in vogue. There's a lot of people doing it. There's a lot of people in Birmingham doing it really well. We wouldn't have done it if we didn't have a unique take on it, and we have a few different talking events that do have a unique take. We've done ones in cafes, we've done ones in cinemas. The range of speakers we have are very varied. You tend to have talks that are one particular type of profession. So I think we are doing something different, but more importantly, it's a good chance to do something a bit more formal for us, which we've typically been very informal. We've been about drinks and socialising. People asked for something more formal. We started doing things like that, and they've been really successful.
Cynthia
Hi.
Who is a superhero. She's a brand strategist, and I don't understand what that is by day. And you organise the Verve Poetry Festival by night.
Yes, I do. So, do you want me to explain both of those things?
That's two hats, isn't it?
That is. Well, it's a lot of hats. It is. I think that the first one, brand strategist. So I work for a agency called Orb, O-R-B. And a brand strategist essentially means that businesses come to us and I bring their brands to life through words, through strategy, to help them grow. And yeah, that's what I do.
So someone comes to you and says, I have no idea what to call a mobile phone company. And you say, call it Orange. They'll love it. That kind of thing.
Yeah, a little bit of that, but also helping them with some of the business planning beforehand as well. So they're going, we've been growing really, really quickly. We want to increase our growth. We don't quite know how to get our employees on board. We don't quite know how to speak to our customers. So they come to Orb, and that's what we do for them. So.
And as if that's not enough, that's a very creative daytime job, I think.
It is, yeah.
By night, and probably in between on the weekends. You're kind of organising poetry events.
Yeah, in the morning, on my lunch break, in the morning, evenings.
Okay, yeah.
I don't sleep a lot. Yes, I do. So in February of 2017, I was one of the co-directors of Verve Poetry Festival, which was Birmingham's first ever poetry and spoken word festival. It took place at Waterstones. It was the first of its kind, really, for the city. It was a great, great deal of fun.
So is that contemporary poetry? Or
contemporary poetry, yes. Yeah. So we had some of the UK's best poets who are currently writing, performing, touring, come to Verve and really showcase what they had. And it was a real mix of both page poetry, you can't see it, but I'm using kind of quotation marks, page poetry and stage poetry. So it was a real mix of electrifying talent, you know, household names, but also people that were up and coming, regional voices, national voices, local voices. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
And is that something else that you're going to plan to repeat? Is that a continual thing?
We are definitely, personally I would hope so. So currently...
there's a scoop building here.
There's
I can
a scoop.
Yeah, yeah.
No, not quite. The team is going to get back together like a 90s pop band very soon.
Yes.
And we're going to be talking about what Verve 2018 looks like. So how the festival, what we learned from this year, obviously it being the inaugural year, what we want next year to look and feel like, what the format might be, you know, programming, branding, all of that. So those conversations will start to happen again. But I think for the moment it's kind of taking a breath, taking a pause. Reflecting on everything that happened.
And talking is very much why you're here.
It is, yes.
Are you talking about the frustration over your cornflakes, about which poetry to choose, or the frustration over, oh, what should that brand look like? Or a bit of both?
I'm going to be focusing on Verve and how it came about, why we did it, the kind of the ethos and the brand vision of it. But it's a talk that's going to touch on branding as well as some of my own poetry, because I was recently published.
I was going to ask you about that.
Were you?
I think people organise things.
Yes.
Often by default, people that do these things, aren't they? You know?
Not always. Okay. Not always. I think it takes a little bit of a different part of your brain to write poetry than it does to kind of organise a festival. But a lot of the same things kind of go into that sense of you're pouring your heart and soul. It's a very creative endeavour. But yes, I recently got published by Midlands-based Nine Arches Press. It was part of a national scheme to find kind of emerging talent in association with the poetry school. So I will have books on me for sale this evening.
That is excellent news. But if folks aren't here this evening, I mean, why wouldn't they be here?
Why wouldn't they be? Why aren't you here?
If they're not here and they're listening now on the radio.
If they're not here and they're listening.
Where should they find these things?
Very good question. They should go to ninearchespress.com. That's ninearchespress.com. And they can find the book there. It's listed under Primers Volume 2. So I was one of two other poets that got selected as part of this scheme. And so these about 14, 15 poems have never been published anywhere ever in magazines, on websites, on blogs. So the first time you're reading them will be in this very slim but attractive volume of poetry.
That is a precious thing indeed.
It is.
And thank you for that, and good luck with your talk.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's more from Small Talk 2017 in the last part of the show. And now we move to an exploration of klezmer music by way of my recent conversation with touring project band Supreme, Sklamberg and the Shepherds, prior to their recent illumination of the stage at MAC Birmingham.
I'm here with Polina, Lauren and Merlin.
Yeah.
I've got that right, just about. And we're in the MAC. It's a little bit chilly.
Yeah.
It's a spring evening, but the glasses are charged. And we're quite excited because we're just sort of pre-gig.
Yep.
Now, first of all, I want to ask you about the band. and whether it is a band or whether it's a project. So do you want to explain a little bit about that, a bit of context for me?
I would go as far as to say as it's a project band, or a bandy project.
I like that. Okay, so what I mean by that is you all do different things, but you've all kind of come together to explore a particular style.
We are part of this big world of klezmer music, so we've known each other for quite a while, played in different contexts, in different bands, with each other, or separately for many years, so we were aware of each other's styles and creativity for you know, all that time, so we just threw things together and then it became a project. But basically it's both, it's a band and it's a project.
So you used a key word there, which I think folks might need some help with, which is klezmer. I only know one person who knows what klezmer is.
I would say that klezmer music is not a folk music.
Okay.
I would say that it was played by professional musicians in the Pale of Settlement, which was the area that Jews were allowed to live in Eastern Europe. And klezmer music, the word klezmer actually means musician. Klei meaning vessel, and zmir meaning song. So the word klezmer means vessel of song, and actually referred to the players themselves, not the music. So to say klezmer music is not strictly a correct thing in terms of the origins of the word. However, at a certain point in the history of the music industry, somebody had to define it and come up with a term and remove the J word from it and make it marketable, and they called it klezmer music.
Yeah. So its origins, am I right in thinking that it's kind of Romanian, Ukrainian? Is that the mix?
Polish, yeah.
Polish, yeah.
Yeah, so where Jews lived around the Pale of Settlement, and where the spoken language that they spoke from day to day was Yiddish, which is a language that started in Germany and moved with the Jews east, and on its way picked up elements of the Slavic languages from the areas where they settled, and also a good number of Hebrew words. And in fact, it's written in the Hebrew alphabet. So that if you know German and you know Hebrew, it's an interesting conflation of you know, two different cultural things. So, but a lot of the Judeo languages are written in Hebrew characters, but they have different bases. Judeo-Spanish, for instance, or Judeo-Arabic, they're all written in Hebrew characters, but they sound very different from each other.
So that's the other interesting element, isn't it? There's a kind of South Mediterranean, sort of Iberian element as well.
Certainly East European. As we said, Moldova, Romania, Ukraine, Western Russia. Then it starts getting a bit vague.
Yeah.
Starts getting a bit vague. I like to refer to klezmer music. It's essentially it's wedding music.
Yeah.
It was created to play at weddings. About 80% of it is dance music, and the other 20% is ritual music, thereabouts.
Yeah.
And I would define it as East European, Ashkenazi, Jewish wedding music as played for and by Yiddish-speaking people.
And I think that there is, from what I know about it, which is limited, there is a celebratory element to it. It's very rhythmic, it's very joyful, it seems. But I think there is, with all, kind of, I guess, traditional musics, there's still an underlying kind of mood to it.
This is what I usually hear, that klezmer music is happy, jolly dance music, happy, clappy. There is much more to it. When I first came to this music, I thought exactly the same. That was 20 years ago, afraid to say. But what I discovered, that there is this whole other aspect to klezmer music and Yiddish song, which we do as well as part of our project, band project. There is this whole kind of influence of the music of the synagogue, which is prayer modes that went into klezmer music, which is all these doiners and all these meditative pieces, or pieces that were played for the audience for listening. So we have all these other aspects, or slow dances, like Chora is not necessarily a fast dance. It's in 6/8 or in 3, but it's more relaxed and more, I would say, well, it's not 20, end of 20th century youth, happy, jumpy people. It's something else.
It's not
and it's
pop,
community.
It?
No. And it's about community, and it's about bringing community together in all sorts of different modes, in all sorts of different ways of being together. And that would include sadness, that would include all sorts of things.
So it kind of, in some ways, I think it kind of has some sort of parallels to kind of jazz and to swing music in some ways, in the sense that it's quite rhythmic and it's quite upbeat in some ways, but it does have that kind of tone, you know, it kind of has that sort of, not melancholy, but it has that sort of richness, that depth. Is that what you're trying to say, or have I stepped over a mark?
It's what you're trying to say.
It's what I'm trying to say, yeah, that's true.
I would not draw a comparison between swing or jazz and klezmer music. It serves a very, very different function in the community. The whole point of, at least to my understanding, the whole thing with swing and jazz was that it was a backlash against, by black Americans, against the oppression they were under. It's an explosion of energy. It's a very, very different thing. All of the modes and the vast majority of the melodies that are played within klezmer music have their roots in religious music. So klezmer music somehow forms a stepping stone between sacred and secular. It has this kind of, it's somewhere in between. And all the melodies are based on these modes that come directly from the synagogue, from prayer. So there is this spirituality inherent within the music that there isn't in swing and in jazz. There's also no improvisation, or very little improvisation in klezmer music. It's interpretive rather than improvisatory. Different style altogether. Has a different cultural place.
Was drei Badal.
places, yeah. I think. So how did that happen? So just for the record, I think you're from Siberia.
Yeah, I was born there and I lived in Tatarstan.
It's cold there, isn't it?
I find Britain much colder, to be honest.
And Lauren, you're an American.
Yeah, I grew up in Southern California.
I detected that from your accent.
Yeah, I grew up in a suburb of LA and in a conservative religiously speaking, in a conservative Jewish community. And so I sort of heard, if not the music, I heard the language of the flavor of this culture growing up. So if I didn't actually hear any klezmer music, I did hear people who spoke Yiddish. I did hear people in synagogue who sounded like they were, and they, in fact, they were from Eastern Europe. So I heard some of that growing up, but
it's
didn't.
It's kind of osmosis, almost.
Well, when I came back around to this music as an adult, there were things that I heard in my childhood and growing up that I was able to understand where they came from. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but basically, I made this big kind of circle in a way. And now I'm performing music that a lot of which my grandmother and her generation would have completely been at home with it. And it's unfortunate that I didn't speak Yiddish with my grandmother and her siblings because they all spoke Yiddish and that would have been very, very cool.
And Merlin, you're from the UK. Is that right?
Not strictly, no. I'm from Wales.
Okay. I sense where you're coming from there.
I'm from the disunited, the ununited kingdom. I'm from Wales. I was born in Wales.
Uh-huh.
Born in Wales. My family were very, 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 very secular. We weren't a religious family at all, although the extended family were very religious, some of them quite orthodox, but not my parents and my two brothers and I. We had nothing to do with it. We didn't like it.
Fair enough.
My dad's very very anti-dogma, and he kind of pushed that on us quite hard when we were kids. However, his dad was born in a small Welsh town called Ystad Lavera, and not too far from Swansea, closer to Swansea than Cardiff. And his parents were from Siemiatycz Grodno, which now is in Poland, but on their immigration papers it says Russia. And my grandfather's first language was Yiddish, and his second language was Welsh, and his third language was English.
Wow.
Now, he spoke English with a very strong Welsh accent, so he must have spoken Welsh with a strong Yiddish accent, although growing up, I couldn't recognize it at the time. But he did speak Welsh, and he did sing songs, and he did take culturally very Welsh. He took us to the rugby.
So let's talk a bit about your instruments, if you like. So, Merlin, you're weapon of choice, if you like, is the clarinet,
yes.
I believe. Is it a particular type of clarinet, or is it a...
I have two weapons of choice. One is a clarinet in G, and the other is a clarinet in C. And they're both early systems. They're both... One of them is a new instrument, but made in the old system, made for the Turkish market, because the Turks still play the early system. And that's the G. And the C is from... I think it's made in 1920 something, and it's got the early fingering system, because that's what they play back in the day. So I decided many years ago, 20 years ago or so, to change to the early instruments to work out exactly how they got that sound and that feel, and play those ornaments. So that was quite important to me, to understand the fingering systems and why they played in such keys and why they did this and why they did that. And having the right instrument helps.
Another different language for you to kind of take on.
Sure.
And Lauren, you play a number of things. You play an accordion and a piano, and you use your vocals. You're a vocalist as well.
I'm primarily a singer. Mm. The other stuff I learn mostly to accompany myself singing and accompany other people playing other instruments and such. But mostly I think of myself as a singer. I learned to play the piano and the guitar around the same time. And then accordion I taught myself when I was in high school.
Mm. That's quite a tricky instrument, isn't it?
Not if you play keyboard. If you play keyboard, the only thing you have to learn is the buttons on the left side, but they're not, if you understand Western harmony, it's not that complicated. So it was an easy instrument to teach myself. And also, I heard it a lot because I was involved with a lot of international folk music. I was involved with the folk dance scene in Los Angeles, international, like recreational folk dancing, so from the Balkans and from Israel and different places. So I heard all this music, around me.
Helena, your instrument of choice is the piano and your voice. It's similar to Lauren, but in a different way.
It's actually similar because I primarily think of myself as a singer and I accompany myself on the piano, although I studied piano as my instrument when I was a child.
Yeah.
I got through 17 years of academic musical training with that. But I was brought up as a classical musician and then I switched to klezmer music when I was quite young. So I think that's my, it's not a traditional instrument for old klezmer music, but it's becoming traditional now, certainly for accompanying Yiddish songs.
And do you travel with a piano?
I wish I could, because sometimes we are provided very interesting, bashed, out-of-tune instruments, and then sometimes we are provided keyboards, but here we have quite a beautiful instrument, the Bösendorf. I like, enjoy playing a concert grand, always, any day.
Excellent. So, I'm conscious your food is on its way.
Yes.
It's winding away to give you energy.
Balti.
Right
choice for them.
Give you energy for a performance.
Yes.
So I'm going to wish you luck with that.
Thank you.
And you've got a few more dates, I think, on the kind of spring tour that you're doing today.
This is our third date.
Out of ten.
So,
excellent. So you kind of...
Tomorrow we're somewhere else, and the day after we're somewhere else.
And don't ask us where it is. We can't remember anymore. We're going to Bangor and Wales, and then we're going to Bristol, then we're going to... a few more towns,
all
and then ending up
on
in
the
London.
Yeah. Sklamberg and the Shepherds' recent concert is part of Making Tracks, a travelling season of shows bringing the newest music from around the globe to a local setting in partnership with some of the best venues across the UK. For more information, go to makingtrackslive.co.uk/about. Google Mr. A. Singh and you will find a host of creativity, and it's all down to one man, serial live streamer and Periscope user extraordinaire, Amrit Singh, who I spoke to before his masterclass in how to be genuine about your online content. Okay, so I'm with Amrit Singh.
That's right.
And Amrit, you're described as a number of things, one of which is a broadcaster.
That's right.
Which tells me instantly I might be in trouble.
No, it's a slightly different type of broadcaster. It's a live streamer. A live streamer is someone who uses a live stream platform like Periscope or Twitch or Facebook Live and creates a community based on that.
So tell me about Periscope, because I know a little bit about it.
Yep.
So it's quite the thing, isn't it?
It is. I mean, live streaming, that's what my talk's mainly going to be about on. Live streaming came about 2 years ago. I joined a year and a half ago. It was bought by Twitter, so it's owned by Twitter. And it was the first platform where you could live stream from your mobile device. Whereas all the previous kind of live stream platforms, mainly it's from a computer or various equipments or paying someone to do it. So it was very exciting, very new. And I started to share my stuff when it came to my journey, my thoughts, travels, exhibitions. But the one side that really took off was art and creativity.
So imagine that's a really powerful tool, isn't it?
Very powerful.
I think I'm instantly thinking about the influence that could have on journalism and on citizen journalism and all those kind of things.
Well, citizen journalism has all of a sudden become a number one word, whereas everyone has a power in their hands to report the news, but not edited or biased. It's like raw to the point. Last year, for 3 months, I did a whole refugee crisis kind of covering with live streaming. So I was one of the first on the ground in Lesbos, Calais, Dunkirk, Berlin to live stream the whole crisis. We were in Greece before the BBC were there. And it was because of the live streams that we were doing, the BBC turned up. That's how powerful. So we reached 50, 60,000 people just from one mobile phone.
It's interesting, isn't it, how that's changed. How, you know, in days, well, maybe 10, 20 years ago, people would have switched the news on or flicked the radio on.
Exactly.
Now they're on their phone, and it's on, as you've just said, those big corporations are playing catch-up.
They do. I mean, what's really interesting now is that there's a whole change in how big corporations use this footage. So instead of going out and paying for someone or a journalist to go to a country, they'll find someone who's already there, who's live streaming, and use their content. So it's kind of like all of a sudden everyone has the potential to be a journalist, to share very, very powerful footage. But it also gives everyone the power as well to protect themselves from anything that happens as well. They have evidence. There's a lot of news in America where people getting stopped over, live streaming straight away. They have this, it's not just proof, but everyone sees it. So it's very interesting how it's been used.
It sounds dangerous, but exciting.
It's powerful. I wouldn't call it dangerous, it's powerful. Yes. Yeah.
So that's a lot of things that you do. But there are other creative things that you do and that you started with.
That's right. Well, I've been a designer for 10 years. Yeah. So I do branding and advertising. And I'm also an artist. So because of live streaming, my art side has taken off. And my art brand, Ink Anima, has all of a sudden become international. I sell my artwork worldwide. I've exhibited in San Francisco, in Birmingham, in London, in the last 5 months, purely through live streaming. So the power is immense. I don't actually see my life. If I didn't have live streaming, it would be very slow to get where I am right now.
2 or 3 years ago, a lot of people wouldn't have seen live streaming as a thing.
No.
That would have come from, you know,
definitely
in the same way that the idea of having a camera in your pocket all the time.
Yeah, that's right.
It's now something we take for granted.
Yeah.
You know, 10, 12 years ago, whatever, it wasn't there. So have you got an inkling? Because I'm sensing you're a man in touch with the future. Have you got an inkling what might happen next, where these things might go?
You know what? It's still early days. Live streaming again. Periscope turned 2 years old. Facebook Live launched theirs after Facebook. Now you have Twitch and Live.me and Busker. You have every day there's a new live streaming platform popping up because they know the power is still there. Even though it's so powerful and it's been around for 2 years, I would say, I think there's a stat out there, don't quote me, but 80% still have no idea what live streaming is. Right? And I just came from a talk right now at Edgebaston Cricket Stadium, and that was aimed at small, medium businesses and marketing and social media professionals. Even though it was social media professionals, a lot of them had no idea or no clue on how to use live streaming for their clients or business. So it's still new, it's still powerful. If you are listening to this and thinking that it's too late for you to use live streaming, it's the complete opposite. It's a perfect time to use it.
It's never too late.
Exactly.
That's a very, very powerful message,
yeah,
I think.
Thank you.
Now, in the way that David Cronenberg makes bizarre films, are you going to be periscoping yourself, periscoping? If you say
periscoping,
what I
mean, with
your talk. Are you going to be... is there a loop?
Sometimes I do.
Yeah.
Not to get stuck in a loop, but live stream what I'm doing. It depends on what I'm trying to provide. So with my live streaming, I cut it down and I share very specific things now. When I first started, I didn't have a clue, so it was very random. Now it's mainly travels, it's mainly about art or creativity and my thoughts. I try to leave events or speaking opportunities off live streaming because it's something that they've already heard. They already know my journey. So I tend to use this and to populate other social media platforms like Instagram Stories or Twitter. Because Instagram Stories and Snapchat, for instance, are a great platform to show the behind the scenes of what someone's doing. And everyone wants to know the person behind the camera, behind the podcast, behind the artwork. And the most powerful part that we can all play in is sharing that. Because then people feel like they're part of what you're creating. And then they're more likely to invest in you as well.
Thanks for your time.
No worries, thank you.
Good luck with your talk.
Thank you.
And I'm now going to go away and Google everything you've done.
All right, okay, brilliant.
Excellent. Thanks.
Cheers, mate.
So, January 2016, I was invited to San Francisco to talk at the Periscope Summit on two talks. And Thursday, the opening night, I walked in, and this is what the most surrealist thing was. It was people who was literally grabbing you, taking selfies, asking you to sign their children's birthday cards, FaceTime their kids because you've inspired them at school with standing up to bullies or doing art for the first time. So that would happen because I started to share my journey. People wanted to know, who are you? Like, why are you doing what you're doing? And what's your background? One of the most, I think, powerful things that you can ever share is your hobbies. Okay, one person asked me a question was, what are your hobbies? And that was probably one of the most life-changing questions. It might be a bit of a surreal question, but prior to Periscope, I had never shown anyone my artwork, right? I'm a designer, I've been doing it for 10 years in branding and advertising. That's me, that's what I've been used to. All of a sudden, what are my hobbies? I like walking, climbing a mountain. Oh, I like creating art. Can we see some of your art? All right, so I went home one day, I think it was September 2015, and I started to share some of my acrylic and watercolor art. I played it safe for a bit. I spent such a long time not creating art, I had to teach myself how to create it again. So for about a year, I was doing live art. It got to a point where people were like yelling at me to say, where is your art? I want to buy your art. And I had to create a website to sell my art. And then it took me a year to really share my passion. So sharing your journey is one of the most powerful things that you can do, because it resonates with people. People connect with you on a level, and you'll realize there might be one, but most likely thousands of people out there in the world who connect and understand exactly where you're going, where you're coming from, and where you're going.
During a well-earned interval, I quizzed curator and organizer Daniel Alcorn about the motivation and history behind the event.
So I'm with Dan Alcorn, who's the organizer.
Director is my official title.
That's a little bit more official, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of Bad Ego. Is that how we're pronouncing it?
That's how you pronounce it, yeah. I'm not the original organizer of Bad Ego. There were a few guys who started it before me who decided upon the name, and they always hated the name. And now I see why, because no one knows how to pronounce it.
So let's talk about Small Talk and Small Talk 2017, where we are now. We're hiding on the landing, just behind it, if you like, here at 1,000 Trades. And there's a real mix of people, isn't there, on the agenda or the programme tonight?
Yeah, and that's what we try and promote. We are all about the arts in Birmingham. We want people who work in the creative community to come together of all different professions and learn from each other. There's a great thing with collaboration where you never know what's going to come from it. Even if just a conversation can spark new ideas, it can inspire you. With people who don't necessarily do the same thing as you but do something very similar, and there's loads of potential for crossover, and it doesn't happen enough. And what we really try and promote is people learning about other people's industries, and in doing so, you kind of, it opens new doors for you.
Now, in some ways, at the moment, the kind of the spoken word event is very much en vogue, isn't it? It's very popular. It's a very old idea.
We toyed with the idea for ages of having talks, because, like you said, it's in vogue. There's a lot of people doing it. There's a lot of people in Birmingham doing it really well. We wouldn't have done it if we didn't have a unique take on it, and we have a few different talking events that do have a unique take. We've done ones in cafes, we've done ones in cinemas. The range of speakers we have are very varied. You tend to have talks that are one particular type of profession. So I think we are doing something different, but more importantly, it's a good chance to do something a bit more formal for us, which we've typically been very informal. We've been about drinks and socialising. People asked for something more formal. We started doing things like that, and they've been really successful.
For more information on Small Talk 2017 and other creative events, go to badego.org.uk. That's badego.org.uk. And now it's time to close the box. We'll be back for our next show on Wednesday the 7th of June at 7 o'clock. But until then, check out more information and links on our blog at thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. My thanks to Making Tracks, Sklamberg and the Shepherds, and Bad Ego. The New Curiosities Box is a King of the Buttons production for Switch Radio.